So welcome to the presentation entitled The Bridge, a pilot test of a peer navigator intervention for improving the health of adults with serious mental illnesses. It's my pleasure to introduce our presenters, John Brecke and Aaron Kelly. Dr. Brecke is the Francis G. Larson Professor of Social Work Research at the University of Southern California School of Social Work and a fellow in the National Academy of Social Welfare and Social Work. He received his PhD in social welfare from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Brecke's research focuses on the improvement of community-based services for people diagnosed with severe mental illness. Dr. Kelly is a visiting scholar at the School of Social Work, University of Southern California, and a postdoctoral fellow in history and social studies of medicine at the Semmel Institute, University of California, Los Angeles. She earned her PhD in psychology from the University of California at Irvine. Her research focuses on interventions designed to aid individuals with serious mental illnesses to improve both their access to physical health care services and the quality of their interactions with medical providers. Please join me in welcoming our presenters.
So YouTube and Twitter, I don't think I've ever been so connected, to be completely honest with you. Not even Facebook. But thanks, Judith, for the opportunity to come and share with you some of the work that we're doing in California. I've really enjoyed the presentations here and the conversations that I've had with a few of you. It's been very stimulating. It's nice to come and get my own idea space expanded. So greetings from California. We've had a few geographic references. I just wanted you to know that in California, no one's an outlier. We have a community for everybody. As a friend of mine at the University of Wisconsin says, one of the great contributions of California to the national psyche is that you allow us all to feel a little more normal. So I just want to give you greetings from us in California. It's also, after 35 years in the mental health field, it is so gratifying to see peer-centered, peer-driven, peer-delivered services really beginning more and more to move to the forefront. It's just enormously gratifying to see that. And this work that we've been doing, working with peers as navigators, has really been the most gratifying work that I've done in my career. And good morning to everyone. So we've talked a lot throughout the last day and a half about health disparities in this population. And in a paper that Aaron and I have just recently put out, we've tried to talk about this issue as in order to deal with these health disparities, we sort of need two things happening at once. We need a top-down, we need a healthcare system that's receptive and responsive. This needs to be looked at in terms of financing, access, policies, organizations, practitioners. That's the top-down piece. And the bottom-up piece is consumers who are ready to be active in the system and in their own healthcare. And throughout the last day and a half, we've looked at various pieces of all of these in really nice ways. And there are many types of integration models. This is not meant to be an exhaustive list at all. Yesterday, in the morning, we saw two wonderful examples of what I would call single roof models. And by the way, all of these have their strengths and weaknesses. But single roof models like the ones we saw yesterday morning, I can't remember the names now, I'm really sorry. But you know the ones that we were talking about. It's kind of that time of life when you play the game, name that noun. And I'm doing that a lot these days. But thank God we were all here in the room and you know what I'm referring to. Trilogy and thresholds, it takes a village to have a memory. Thank you. I appreciate that greatly. But from Trilogy and Thresholds, you saw these two wonderful single roof models where healthcare providers and mental health care providers are bumping elbows all the time, grinding it out. And then, of course, there are some collaborative care models that are oftentimes situated in primary care with either in-house or virtual mental health consultations. The folks I've talked to that do those models kind of like to carve out the seriously mentally ill and send them somewhere else. But nonetheless, these are models that are around. And finally are linkage models, which are sometimes, again, this is not an exhaustive list, sometimes these linkage models, like the one we are going to be describing today, are situated in mental health clinics, and we are navigating consumers to off-site healthcare services. So that's the kind of model we'll be talking about today. And it's a model that we call the bridge. I've been told that that's such a commonplace term that we might want to find another term, but I'm not good at either marketing or creative PR work, so we're using that for now. But we call it, we describe it as a comprehensive healthcare engagement and self-management intervention. And to pull that apart a little bit, we call it comprehensive because our goal is to connect consumers to primary care, specialty health care, and substance abuse services as they are needed. It's an engagement model because what we have found working in California, and I realize there's some very interesting geographic dynamics that impact how these populations are defined and what their needs are. But the individuals that we're dealing with in California with serious mental illness are really not successfully, in many cases, not successfully engaging a consistent primary health care provider or health home, or they've just given up trying to access and use outpatient primary care. I think this is a common dynamic in California. From what I've read, it's a common dynamic in many, many states, and we see it over and over and over again. Since we begun this work in California, actually they've done a nice job out there of getting people assigned to a provider. And many people can show us the letter now that gives them the name of the doctor, which unfortunately is about as far as it usually goes, is that they know they have a provider. And when we further query about how many times have you gone, do you know where what the address is, do you know how to get there, unfortunately, far too often, almost most of the time, the answer is, I don't have a clue, but I know I've got a doctor. So it's a self-management program because our goal is to train and empower consumers to be assertive self-managers of their health care so that their interactions with these providers can be more effective and consistent over time. We also use an in vivo approach. We want to develop these self-management skills in real-world healthcare settings. So our peer navigators are in the waiting room. They're in the exam room. They're working with the docs and the consumers to get follow-up care plans written that they can understand. And so we're out there in these settings, in the pharmacies, in the primary care offices, in the specialty care offices with our consumers. But we do that in a particular way. Our intervention mantra, I've decided we had to have one, that tried to capture and explain in a very short number of terms what it is we're trying to create. And what we came up with was for them, with them, and by them. Now, from the consumer's perspective, that would be for us, with us, and by us. But from the provider perspective, from the peer navigator, we asked them to conceptualize this and to think about this as modeling, coaching, and fading. First, we do something for a client. The navigator performs the task, and the consumer observes. You could think of this as making an appointment, where we will often have a phone, put it on speaker. The navigator will make the first call to the doc. The consumer will be listening, and the navigator will go through all of the complications that go on when you call a doctor's office. And we just from that exercise alone, we immediately begin to see the roadblocks that occur for these individuals again and again. So in our for them phase, our modeling phase, the navigators perform the task and the consumer observes. And then we want them to move to the coaching phase, the with them phase, where the consumer performs the task and the navigator coaches. And finally is our fading phase, where the navigators are trained to move back as the consumer begins to self-manage and the navigator provides ongoing support as needed. So this is what we're trying to create as a self-management milieu. And we have a lot of criteria for what a good model is, what a good coach is, and what it looks like to fade, and what skills you need to be a good fader. And we conceptualize this intervention, in three phases. An intensive 3 months of assessment, modeling, and coaching. Another phase where self-management emerges. And finally, after that, ongoing support and boosters as needed. Now, having said this, those of you that have worked in this field know that there's tremendous individual variation. That would go without saying, and we see repeatedly, that there are some consumers who move very quickly to self-management. Interestingly, some of our younger consumers. and then we have individuals who have had, and this was brought up in a couple of presentations I was in yesterday. One of the iatrogenic, unfortunate factors in some care in the community is that we have individuals who are providers who have found that it's much more efficient in the short term to do things for people. They get their billing paradigm down, they get their billing strategies down, and they have discovered that if they make a phone call, it's done and taken care of very effectively in the short term. And so we have individuals who have learned that if they just sort of wait, somebody else is going to do it. So we have to work very hard at engaging consumers and building their motivation. Motivational interviewing was mentioned earlier. We found that those strategies can be very helpful. But given this as a kind of average approach to what we do, knowing that there's going to be a lot of individual variation around that. Thanks a lot. Okay, good. So we've kind of conceptualized a whole set of challenge points to what prevents people from getting good healthcare outcomes. And you can see it starts with health and wellness needs, the consumer's own awareness of their health needs, all the way through provider contacts, getting to the appointment, waiting room experience, exam room experience, treatment plan, and follow-up. And we've designed the navigator's role around each of these critical points where things can become unglued. And literally, we have seen people make it all the way to the exam room, and after 30 minutes in the exam room, they walk out of the clinic. And they've said, I've done all I can do. I can't take any more of this. And they leave. And, of course, our navigators are trained to walk with them and engage them and try to bring them back. So our navigator roles are built around a number of these challenge points. So I want to, rather than spend time going through a lot of our results, I'm going to summarize those very, very briefly and talk about some of the things that I've gotten more interested in recently in our work. The critical elements of this intervention, consumer screening and engagement, and these are the skills that we're building in our health navigators to do screening and engagement. And by screening, I don't mean screening for health conditions. I mean screening for the need for health navigation. So we have a series of about 7 questions that consumers can answer yes or no to. And any one of them, a particular answer, either yes or no, screens them into the need for health navigation. And engagement has turned out to be an extremely important piece of what our peer navigators do. It's engaging the consumers in the need for health navigation. Many of them have had horrible experiences going to the ER when they have the flu. As we all know, that's exactly the wrong way to use the healthcare system. But it's a rational decision when you have not had any success at getting outpatient medical care. So to go to urgent care or the emergency room when you feel horrible is actually a rational decision. It never works well, or rarely works well, when you have a condition that's not ready for the emergency room. So we have assessment. Goal setting has been mentioned by a number of people. Goal setting is incredibly important to empowerment. And then preparing for the medical appointment, navigating the appointment, reviewing the appointment, follow-up care plan, and then self-management of health care. These are the elements that we train our peers to become skilled in. And so these skills, such as engaging and connecting with consumers, assessment, building commitment for self-management, you know, getting people to believe that they can self-manage their health care is not an easy piece for people to grab onto who have had some really awful experiences in the medical system or who have just given up. So we work to build that belief that this is something they can begin to do over time. And many of our health navigators will have conversations with their consumers, and it will be the consumer will end up saying, really, you really believe I can do this? And our peers say, yes, we see it happen again and again and again. And as we all know, when you see that light kind of happen with someone, it's really wonderful. So making collaborative plans for goals, accessing, utilizing healthcare, and, of course, our modeling, coaching, and fading. Now, one of the things we've really gotten interested in recently is looking at what are the skills that consumers develop? What are we asking them to do? What are the skills we're asking them to do? So I'm just going to highlight a few of these. We've actually broken all of these down into very specific behavioral indicators, but that would make these slides really complicated, and I'd just like to give you a brief overview of this. But these skills are around assessing medical services, finding them, transportation, making and keeping appointments, utilizing those services, preparing for the medical visit, how to communicate with medical staff. Now, remember, all of this stuff is done in vivo. We're not doing this in a classroom setting. So our navigators are out there doing modeling, coaching, and fading in the waiting room, in the exam room, and in the pharmacies. So all of these skills are being developed in the community. And then maintaining health, being organized about their health care. A couple of people have talked about using personal health organizing strategies, and Erin will be talking in a minute about electronic personal health records that she's been working on with a group. And achieving wellness goals and prioritizing health needs. These are the skills that we're looking to build in our consumers. And two of them that have come up that were a bit surprising to me is asking for support to overcome roadblocks. I think this is tied into this kind of passivity that happens with some consumers after years and years in the mental health system, that one of the things we need to do is train them to actively ask and seek support as they move forward. And then managing emotions and symptoms during medical activities. This has become incredibly important because the things we're asking, they're stressful for me. I use a lot of self-management strategies when I go to the physician, anyone in the medical area. And we found that our consumers need to learn how to manage their emotions, ranging from frustration and anger and outright wanting to pull your hair out to symptoms that can become exacerbated during kind of complicated and stressful medical situations. So the history of Bridge, very briefly, is we started this in 2008. We had money to build it, manualized it. We did a pilot study, very small pilot study, feasibility study with 24 individuals, and I'll briefly review that with you. We were funded by the UniHealth Foundation, thanks to them. We were able to do as much work as we have done. Had some funding from the National Institute of Mental Health through an IP RISP grant that I had, and from the CTSI at USC. So here's some of the healthcare problems that we've looked at in our samples. And you can see the percentage of these 24 individuals that had these. Quite alarming. Nurses that look at this get nervous very, very quickly. Our health navigators have learned that this is just routine. As a summary, about 100% have two or more of these medical problems. Over 75% have five or more of these medical problems. And almost 50% have 10 or more of these medical problems. Currently, this is not lifetime. This is what we ask them right now. Do you have this? So it's quite alarming. Our findings from that very small pilot were that, this was after giving my pre-docs a lecture on this is a very small sample. We're not going to get any significant findings. We're just going to look for trends and effect size. And wouldn't you know, our effects were very large. And these are some of the statistically significant findings we got. Sort of like taking your nephews to the casino and saying, watch what happens when I put this quarter in. And then you win $25. So What we did find is that we were successful at reducing, it actually happened to me, and my nephews still remember it. You know, they look at me and think, thanks, Uncle John. We really learned a lot about gambling today. A quarter becomes $25 just like that. Bingo. But we did show a reduction in those health problems, as well as a reduction in bodily pain related to health problems and bodily pain that interfered with normal functioning. It impacted the use of medications in a way we didn't even anticipate, and Aaron dug into these data that we found that folks were using less physical health medications, and we couldn't quite figure this out. Their problems were going down, and their use of physical health care, physical meds, meds related to their physical conditions also decreased, and the best we could figure is that it was much more targeted, systematic use because they were going to a doc they had a relationship with. They weren't getting bombarded with scripts at an emergency room, most of which didn't get filled. And we also saw a very nice shift in the locus of healthcare away from the ER and the urgent care to outpatient primary care, which is good for health, it's good for our consumers, and it's also obviously less expensive. But those first two are primary. We also found positive findings in terms of acceptability to clients and agency staff, tolerability for the clients. We weren't asking them to do things that they found aversive or that they couldn't handle. Feasibility of integration into the clinic and the teams, this has become a big thing that we've started talking about, as well as feasibility for our peer providers. We weren't asking them to do something that was overwhelming to them. We were providing enough support and training. And in fact, when we interviewed some of our peer health navigators, we found this helper principle operating very nicely in terms of increased self-esteem for our navigators, newfound confidence, high job satisfaction, and they were also more likely to take control of their own health care when they were helping others do the same. I've actually gotten better at it myself. We're now doing a PCORI-funded study where we have randomized 150 consumers to immediate health navigation or a six-month wait list. We're doing interviews every 6 months. And we have three peer health navigators now with caseloads of about 20 each. So this population we're dealing with are folks who are an assertive community treatment kind of population. I cut my research teeth back in the 80s at the ACT program in Madison, a PAC program in Madison, and so I'm a big believer in intensive services for people at a period of time where they need it. And so the caseloads are fairly small because this is intensive work with these individuals because it is self-management generating. It's an empowerment model, and as we tell our folks, it takes a lot longer to teach someone how to make a call than it does to make the call for them. So we're working with small caseloads and at one agency site within Pacific Clinics. The last thing I'll mention is that we're doing something now that a number of you have talked about or I've heard talked about in a few presentations is how do you get agencies ready to do this? That is a big issue. So we've started looking this in terms of three stages, preparing the agency staff and supervisors. They've got to wrap their heads around what health navigation is in the context of a mental health clinic. They've got to begin to wrap their heads around what is it to work with peers, to have a peer-delivered intervention, train the navigators, and then integrating the intervention into the agency practices. So we got more money from the InHealth Foundation. We've manualized an agency model, and thank you. And we're looking at the feasibility of an implementation manual for use by agency practitioners. Want to recognize and thank our Bridge team, consisting of a collection of people from USC and Pacific Clinics, and our peer health navigators who are active on this project. There are about 40 peer health navigators trained within Pacific Clinics now. Which is really nice, and we've been training people in L.A. In this model, and the L.A. County Department of Mental Health has been very supportive of that. Here are a couple of publications that dig into the conceptual model and our findings in much greater detail, and we'd be happy to send those to you. And I'm going to turn this over now to Dr. Kelly, who's been working with us, generalizing this to a homeless mentally ill population, and she'll be talking about electronic personalized health records as a nice add-on to this. Aaron.
you. Hi. So I guess what I'd like to start with is just sort of our review of the literature. We recently conducted a systematic review of self-management interventions for people with serious mental illnesses. And we found 14 studies that met our criteria. And we really wanted to understand how much is self-management a part of interventions that are out there, and how much evidence is there that people can do self-management. Because we see that self-management is a really critical part of whether or not healthcare becomes a priority and is a sustaining priority for people. And we did find that there's some promising preliminary evidence that consumers can collaborate with their health professionals to become self-managers of their health and their health care. But sort of surprisingly, only 8 of the 14 studies that we reviewed actually included a measure of self-management. despite it being a central premise for these interventions, people weren't necessarily examining it with an attitudinal measure. And but we did find that of the studies that did include one, 5 studies did find evidence for improvement. One was a large RCT, 2 were some pilot studies that included effect sizes from about 0.4 to 0.6, and then 2 didn't include effect sizes. But we did find some very promising evidence that that is happening. And even among the 5 studies that didn't have a specific measure of that attitudinal change, we did see positive medical outcomes in terms of lost weight, better management of diabetes, so indicators that are suggesting that people are really getting engaged about their health care. And we also found some evidence that peers on their own or as a part of a collaboration with other professional staff are successfully able to implement these types of interventions. So we really are excited about the opportunities for peers to become a bigger part of not just the mental health services side, but also their physical health services. And now I'm going to talk about something that makes doctors groan, electronic health records. Everyone's very excited about them. Doctors will constantly bemoan the fact that sometimes they glitch out. But the federal government has really made this a big priority, and about 75% of practices across the U.S. are now at least trying to use their electronic health record systems. And the goal has been here to really improve communication between mental health providers and medical providers, and to really just make it easier for all of us to not lose information, not wait 6 weeks for someone to fax over your medical records. Unfortunately, we've really found that people with serious mental illnesses have been excluded from most of these studies with electronic health records. There's been a lot of concern that they're going to misinterpret the information, that, you know, they're just somehow not able to handle this. And we really wanted to see if we could challenge this limitation of expectations. So when I talk about personal health records, there are several different models that might be out there. One is the idea where their medical provider has a sort of portal where they can access their medical records, and so they can just log in and take a look at them. But some people have also found that, you know, that's great if you're only seeing one type of medical provider, if you're in, like, the Kaiser system. But other people have thought, well, maybe we need a sort of separate program. And so there are things like Microsoft's Health Vault, where you can import information from multiple providers and put it into one record. But there are limitations with that because we can't guarantee the security of that data. You don't have a contract with them. So if there's a data breach, they don't have to tell you. And that can be rather troubling if you're the Department of Mental Health of Los Angeles, in which case they were like, no, you cannot use that. So we had to get a little bit more creative. And we thought about would it be like if we had health information that was stored by the mental health agency. And so we actually created a dual system, one that is a management tool for our health navigators, so they can manage all of their health navigation activities, contact logs, forms, assessments, screening, and so the staff has their access, And then consumers are also given access through their portal, and this is a way that they can really improve their connection to their health navigator. And so we see that a personal health record is something that could really improve the efficacy and the effectiveness of care because it gives people a sense of normalcy. We're engaging them as well as anybody else, even without a serious mental illness. And we also wanted to reduce communication errors across providers. And for the pilot, we chose to work with a homeless population because this is a group that a lot of people dismiss as maybe not having any savviness with the internet. And thanks to the smartphone, we really are finding that consumers are more connected than you would think. But there are people that aren't as able to hold on to, say, a paper medical record. And so giving them a backup system of having a place where they can upload all of their forms from what they get from the doctor and have it in one place, have it safe, that can be a really good benefit for them. And we're also hoping that this means that people will be more likely to stay engaged with their healthcare long term, because we're really expecting that as they faded out some of their contact with their health navigator, that this is a way for them to stay engaged and reminded about the skills that they learned. And so, as I said before, people with SMI are often excluded also from studies that are specific to just personal health records. And this is a group that really can benefit from it because they have multiple doctors, inconsistent insurance access, poor record keeping. They tend to have multiple chronic conditions. In our pilot phase so far, we found that they have an average of 14 symptoms. So almost twice what we found in our initial pilot. So these are people who are very sick. And on average, they've been to the doctors about once or twice in the last 6 months. So if you could imagine that if you have 14 symptoms and you're just not even going to the emergency room, it's a pretty serious set of issues that they're having. And they also tend to have really complicated treatment regimens. People are on up to 18 medications, so it's pretty out of control. So we designed two phases to our study. The first phase is where we created the new personal health record system, and then we wanted to demo it to medical providers, to mental health providers, and the consumers, and get their feedback. Is this something you would use? What kind of access have you had to electronic health records, to health applications, things like that? Then the second phase is to actually use the personal health record system as a part of health navigation. And this is just a couple of screenshots of our system from the consumer side. And we really made it as simple as possible. There are links, and if you click on any of the links, then you can view, edit, or print that information. Now, they can't change the information that their health navigator has put in, but they can, you know, update their own information, and they can keep track of new medical diagnoses that they're getting, who their doctors are. They can do forms like our Ask Me 3 form, where people write down in advance three things that they want to talk to their doctor about. So it's very simple. It's easy to type in. They can do it with their navigator, or they can do it on their own. Then they can print out copies and take it with them to the doctor. And one of the things that we found that was really important is really making it clear, these are things that my doctor said, and these are the things that I'm recording. One of the things that we integrated into it is a little bit of a health app idea, where people can record things like your diet, your exercise, if you're taking your blood pressure at home, and seeing how that maps onto what they're finding when they go in for their medication visits with the nurses. And they can also have some graphs, and so that they can see what's my progress on my blood pressure, on my weight, how long I'm exercising, things like that. Surprisingly, I did find that this group exercises a fair bit in terms of walking. Being homeless means that you have 3+ hours of walking a day. When we first showed the system, we found that people were really pretty enthusiastic about the idea. Mental health providers in particular were very enthusiastic, and they were like, yeah, definitely, people can use this. But we did see that the estimates really varied considerably. So some people thought that as little as 10% of this population would be able to use it, where some other people thought 100%. So people had a lot of really wildly different expectations, and I think that medical providers tended to expect the least use by participants. And people really thought that maybe it had to do with lack of access or lack of training on how to use these types of systems. So we really integrated a one-on-one coaching system where we show people how to actually use it, and then we do check-ins to see if they're using the system and why they're not using it. And when we presented it to the consumers, they thought it was really empowering. 9 out of 10 consumers thought that it was something that other people or themselves would use. Only one person was like, no, I don't do stuff for myself. Thanks. which is actually kind of surprising, because this actually happened in the wake of the Target security breach. And so I thought that people were going to be really like, no, you cannot store my information electronically. But I only had one person who was like, are you sure that this can be secure? And we really found that medical providers in particular were very enthusiastic about this idea. They really wanted to get more information, because they said there was a paucity of information that was coming to them from the mental health side. They didn't know all the different things that they needed to know for SSI benefit claims. They wanted more. Oh, so that ended before I expected. That's okay. And so in our phase two stage, we're still in the recruitment phase. We have 12 out of the 40 that we're hoping to recruit. And in terms of some of the barriers that we found, access to computers can be a bit of a challenge, because certain shelters actually do not let you have a laptop in the shelter. They don't want you sitting in the room playing on your computer all day. And so if they do have computers, it's just for looking for a job. And so we did have to provide drop-in hours at the clinic. We have a research assistant there twice a week. During the summer, we had a research assistant there 5 days a week, and they can come in when they come in for their medication appointments or their other appointments and try to utilize the computers then. So it has been a little bit challenging that way. But we are seeing some preliminary signs that people are actually utilizing the record. One particular person that comes to mind wanted even more possibilities to keep track of themselves. They really wanted even more mental health assessments, and it's been very encouraging so far to see this population, who starts off with 14 symptoms, really start to identify a lot of the healthcare issues that are plaguing them.